But that was not the end of the matter. Even Stalin, who had ridden in his youth, had no time for horses and troopers in visual propaganda in his later years as Red Tsar, though he remained conscious of the power of equestrian imagery. When in June 1945, the popular Russian commander-in-chief, Marshal Zhukov, who had previously fought in Budyonny's Red Cavalry, rode a white horse in the Victory Day parade leading Soviet troops across Red Square, page 253, and was subsequently portrayed as the victor over Nazi Berlin in an adaptation, or a travesty, of David's Napoleon, play 21. This was perceived as a bold grab at the old monarchical formula and contributed to his falling out of favor with Stalin. Zhukov vanished into political oblivion and was only reinstated much later by Stalin's successors. Nietzsche was seeking to deconstruct another irrepressible formula, the opposition of military men and lawyers, when, quoting French historian Hippolyte Taine, he sought to uncover Napoleon's loyally side. For Napoleon, the lawyer is as significant as the general and the administrator. The essence of this skill is never to submit to the truth. It was not until years later that the cliché of man of law versus man of action was truly ridden to death. In his short story, The New Advocate, Kafka combines in one protagonist the contrasting duality of jurist and military hero. The steed of Alexander the Great is reincarnated as the eponymous lawyer, once and for all closing this allegorical chapter of world history. In his outward appearance, it is said of the new lawyer, Dr. Bucephalus, there is little to recall the time when he was still the warhorse of Alexander of Macedon. But a simple court usher, with the expert eye of the regular racegoer, sees the truth when he watches the lawyer as he walks up the steps to the court, climbing up with a high-stepping tread that made each of his steps ring out on the marble. Bucephalus is approved indulgently, deserving, on account of his historical importance, at least a sympathetic reception. The era when someone knew how to lead an army to India was long gone, and so the best one could do was what Bucephalus has done, and immerse oneself into the books of law, leafing through the pages of our ancient tomes in the still light of the lamp, far from the din of the Battle of Issus. The time of heroes is over, and with it, that of war horses. All that remains is a lawyer who bears the name of a legendary horse, who brushes the dust off the dossiers with his mane, a silent, virtuous draft horse. When Ulrich, the protagonist of The Man Without Qualities, the novel which Robert Musil began in 1921, 4 years after Kafka's short story, recalls his youthful desire to become an important man, he notes the connection between his former admiration of Napoleon and his decision to enter a cavalry regiment. But when, shortly thereafter, he reads in the newspaper of a genius racehorse, the knowledge dawns on him that the horse has beaten him to the glory, and that sports and strictly objective criteria have deservedly come to the forefront, displacing such obsolete concepts as genius and human greatness. The Fourth Rider. Wrapped in the flag of the United States, the coffin of the president rested on a gun carriage drawn by 6 gray horses. A single standard bearer followed the funeral carriage, a member of the Marine Corps, the branch of the army to which the president himself had formerly belonged. What followed next, in the third position, was for most viewers the most puzzling element in the long procession. Led by a soldier in parade uniform, walked a dark brown riderless horse, restlessly prancing. The animal was fully saddled and carrying a pair of riding boots reversed in the stirrups, as though its rider had been facing backwards before dismounting. As John F. Kennedy had at no point been a cavalryman, it could not be seen as a reference to his military origins. But even if the meaning and origin of the symbol remained obscure to most witnesses of the ceremony on the 25th of November 1963, no one was left untouched by the power of the strange spectacle. The riderless horse with boots reversed, a nervous, prancing and snorting sculpture, evoked nothing less than death. The caparisoned horse is a ceremonial element of the American state funeral. Appearing for the first time at the funeral of George Washington in 1799, this symbolic horse then walked behind Abraham Lincoln's coffin in 1865, before later appearing in the funeral processions of Franklin D. Roosevelt, 1945, Herbert Hoover, 1964, Lyndon B. Johnson, 1973, and Ronald Reagan, 2004. The word caparison, from the French caparaçon, refers to the ornamental covering worn by a horse, which was typical of medieval tournaments and Baroque funeral horses. Despite the name, the caparisoned horse of the U.S. military wears only a bridle, saddle, and an elegant black saddle blanket with a white trim. This sobriety makes the backward-facing boots all the more arresting. Through simple reduction, by omitting the full cover and decorative accoutrement, and adding just one detail, the boots, the military ceremony established its distinct formula for pathos, which can barely be outdone in terms of austerity and intensity. Unlike its Baroque predecessors, it does not speak grandiloquently of the transience of earthly things, the vanity of human existence, and the perpetuity of glory. It gives voice to death itself. And yet the great reverser of all things does not speak. Only the clatter of the horse's hooves breaks the silence. The popular interpretations that accompany the ritual and promise details of its historical origins in fact amount to little more than references to figures such as Genghis Khan, Buddha, and certain Native American chiefs, who were buried along with their horses. Instead of dispersing the fog that obscures its origins, they make it denser. There's an unintentionally comic ring to the explanation that the upturned boots represent the fallen leader, who turns one final time to his troops, as though he had spun around like a gymnast on the horse and had sat down in the opposite direction to that of the procession. The strength of the image is matched by the futility of the interpretations of it. What makes great iconography and strong symbolism is the fact that anyone can feel the impact, even if very few can analyze it. However, the formula of reversal, for example, of weapons or shields, has belonged since the Middle Ages to the ritual of the princely and military funeral cortege, as does the custom of having the coffin of the deceased person followed by his favorite horse. This ceremony was witnessed by the young Hermann Heimpel in Munich before the First World War, on the occasion of the funeral of Prince Regent Luitpold. Erhard watched the funeral procession from a balcony in the Assistrasse, opposite the garden of the Glyptothek. The royal tack room was teeming with life. So many horses, saddlecloths, grooms. The men in cowls proceeded like a gloomy mummer's play before the coffin. This rested on a cart pulled by 12 horses, swathed in black cloth, led by handlers. High up on the box of the hearse sat the coachman in his three-cornered hat, the immense reins in his fists. The deceased was followed by his favorite horse. Spanish Burgundian court ceremony, Erhard heard someone behind him mutter. In contrast to the origins of the ritual, the identity of the American funeral horse is well known. The fidgety horse that followed Kennedy's coffin, constantly prancing about, was called Blackjack. Born in 1947, Blackjack had been in the service of the Army since 1953, serving as the military funeral horse in over 1,000 funeral processions, although he was considered uncontrollable and would constantly disturb the solemn tranquility of the occasion. After 20 years in service, he retired in June 1973. And after his death by veterinary euthanasia in 1976, he was cremated and interred with full military honors in Fort Myer, Virginia, not far from Arlington Cemetery, where John F. Kennedy is buried. With hindsight, what in the eyes of his military superiors constituted Blackjack's biggest weakness, his stubborn disobedience and tendency to fidget nervously, came to be seen as his symbolic strength. After all, in countless myths and folk legends of old Europe, a horse starting with fright and snorting is taken as a harbinger of death in the vicinity. Easily spooked. Popular belief, dubbed by doubters as superstition, and the myths of northern and eastern Europe are full of horses. When these timid animals are particularly nervous and jumpy, this is taken to suggest the proximity of the realm of spirits, or a manifestation of the horse's special divining abilities. A horse's twitchy behavior suggests either that spirits are unsettlingly close at hand, or that the horse itself is in league with the spirit world and therefore has prophetic gifts. No other animal, except the cat, is as strongly affected by the otherworldly. Horses are said to be particularly affected by the ghosts of the dead after dark. At night, spirits and specters like to go for a ride, after all. The many different versions of the legend of Leonora, a maiden who returns from the grave, best known in the form of Gottfried August Berger's Gothic ballad, Lenore, 1774, are eloquent testimony to this midnight riding club, whose tradition continues to this day in the genres of trashy horror and zombie movies, such as Tombs of the Blind Dead, 1972, with its horse-riding skeletons of blinded Spanish knights. The prose narratives of the 19th century also saw the horse as an ally of the spirit empire, or as messengers of death, as we see in Theodore Storm's novella Der Schimmelreiter, 1888, The Dykemaster, or Hugo von Hofmannsthal's The Tale of the 672nd Night, 1895. Neither should we forget the talking horse's head of the Grimm brothers, The Goose Girl. It is hard to imagine a German childhood in the 19th or 20th century without its memorable mantra, O Falada, dost thou hangest there? Naturally, the historian has a more sober perspective and looks for what it is that links these ideas together. Why is it that the image of the horse has such a close, almost brotherly association with the idea of impending death? From the historian's perspective, Reinhard Koselleck proposed a very specific answer, developing a political anthropology based on five categories. The first of these categories speaks of death, or rather of killing. Heidegger's central provision of the march towards death must, in order to make histories possible, be complemented by the corresponding category of the ability to kill. Part of the human condition, as the historian knows well, is the thoroughly political threat of the death of others or at the hands of others. The example Koselleck uses to demonstrate this general point is that of the cavalry charge at Omdurman, as described by Winston Churchill, which the talented British author endows with a timeless quality. Thus, Churchill contrasts the situation of someone sitting strong and ready on their horse with that of another fighter who, whether wounded or thrown from their horse, becomes the victim of an attack. In a similar vein, Koselleck himself at times contrasts the status of mounted soldiers with that of infantrymen or wounded soldiers who face the threat of being trodden under hoof. In fact, the very real, and not merely mythological or literary representation of the horse as a messenger of death, may well have forged from the battlefields of Asia and Europe, where an onrushing cavalry would scatter the army of foot soldiers into flight, if it did not simply trample them to death. Or rather, it would threaten to trample them to death. Real power, in sociologist Nicholas Luhrmann's theory, is not in the stark fact of doing something, but in the subtle possibility of doing it and the demonstration of hypothetical behavior. The exercise of power has a theatrical aspect to it. It is not necessarily the act of violence, but the threat of it. Carried over to the example of the cavalry, the power lies not in the factum brutum of the infantry being overrun or overridden, but in the threat of such a fate that the infantry internalizes. Before it touches the integrity of the body in the form of violence, power is a theater of fear. The horse is the main protagonist at the stage of this theater, because over the course of evolution it has perfected its expression of terror. As Charles Darwin identified, this expressiveness prompts a simultaneous response of mimicry in the beholder and gives a practical trigger to flee a dangerous situation. The actions of a horse, when much startled, are highly expressive. One day my horse was much frightened. His eyes and ears were directed intently forwards, and I could feel through the saddle the palpitations of his heart. With red, dilated nostrils, he snorted violently, and, whirling round, would have dashed off at full speed had I not prevented him. This expansion of the nostrils, as well as the snorting and the palpitations of the heart, are actions which have become firmly associated during a long series of generations with the emotion of terror. For terror has habitually led the horse to the most violent exertion in dashing away at full speed from the cause of danger. Nobody has better grasped the theatrical show of power and its embodiment in the horse and represented it in a more resplendent manner than Peter Paul Rubens in his charging horsemen and savage scenes of boar, lion, and tiger hunts. As Jacob Burckhardt puts it, Rubens paints as no one did before him, the horse sharing in the general tumult and, already swift and wild, bearing its rider into battle. He knows the animal in danger and in rage, and it is to the horse that he gives the expression of great and terrible moments in the conflicts of men or beasts. Rubens and several of his students who followed his example, recognized wherein lay the unique quality of the horse in the representation of power. Not in the power of his physique, however much the sheer size of the horse's body dominated the canvas. The horse was not powerful because it was a large and strong animal, for that would be a trivial conclusion, but because it was a uniquely expressive subject of fear. The horse could spread terror while, or rather because, it was itself imbued with terror, and expressed this like no other creature. The place where a horse's active and passive nervousness is concentrated is in its large, expressive eye. The look that emanates from this eye is not the petrifying stare of Medusa. This eye does not turn a man to stone, but certainly conveys the fear that the stare reflects, the panic, the sheer terror. In the horse's eye, painters found the most concentrated, concise formula for the horror confronted by man and beast alike on the battlefield or at the bloody climax of a hunt. In all the cavalry battles and hunting scenes drawn and painted by Rubens, the eye of the horse, or horses, upon which this particular iconic task fell, is consistently located at the central focal point of the entire composition. The glances of the other protagonists, the men, animals, or monsters, all remain trapped within the picture. They do not break out and make eye contact with the observer. One single eye pierces the observer directly, the chilling stare of a horse. As we consider The Lion Hunt, Plate 23, we feel constantly pierced by this stare, with its unmistakable expression of terror. The wide-open eye becomes the crux of the composition, and the mirror of its power. It is a simultaneously passive and active mirror. The horse embodies power precisely because it is able to sense fear, express it, and pass it on. The light beam of power is concentrated in this rolling prism, this bulging eyeball, to be refracted outwards towards the viewer, the witness, the enemy. The dialectic of this gaze, whose inner contradictions Rubens captures with such clarity and exploits at the fulcrum of his composition, is, of course, the dialectic of the animal itself, which, easily spooked and inclined by nature to flight, has been, as it were, recoded by mankind and converted into a vehicle of terrifying power. When a horse carrying a rider is spooked, it starts and wants to bolt. These are all characteristics of its original nature and have, as Darwin demonstrated, a practical purpose. However, as the poet Albrecht Schaeffer writes, through its beautiful form, the effect on the spectator is as though these features reflected an inner boldness, and as though the terrified eye was in fact burning with a bellicose rage. This is what Rubens saw. Inside the perfect incarnation of power is the expression of sheer terror. Sigmund Freud would also encounter this dual nature of equine fear in the course of his analysis of infantile sexuality. It was little Hans's phobia about horses that brought to his attention the ambivalent relationship between an anxiety about something and a fear of something. In the first conversations recorded by his father, 5-year-old Hans initially expressed his fear of horses suddenly dashing off, adding that the horses will fall down when the cart turns. But a short while later, he added that he was afraid that a horse might fall over and bite him, and thrash around with its legs and make a racket. Here Freud discerned the ambivalence of the phobia which made Hans fear alternately that the horse might bite him and that something might happen to the horse. Freud noted that the biting and the falling horse had been shown to represent his father, who's going to punish him for the evil wishes he was nourishing against him. More than the apparently classic reduction of the father, Freud seems, however, to have been interested in the surprising phase transition within the phobia. It is especially interesting, however, to observe the way in which the transformation of Hans's libido into anxiety was projected onto the principal object of his phobia, onto horses. Horses interested him the most of all the large animals. Playing at horses was his favorite game with other children. When repression had set in and brought a revulsion of feeling along with it, horses, which had till then been associated with so much pleasure, were necessarily turned into objects of fear. The phobic process, wrote Freud, was responsible for raising the horse to become a symbol of terror, and thus represented the preliminary result of a phase transition, which painters had already recognized and exploited for its visual impact. the fleeting transition of the horse from the object of fear to its subject. The Great Collections. The Nameless Stranger, played by Clint Eastwood in Pale Rider, a late Western from 1985, is a wandering, or rather, a horse-riding preacher. In a previous life, he might have been a gunslinger, maybe an outlaw, a desperado. Like all Western heroes, he has a fixed abode of a kind. He comes from nowhere. His back bears the scars of bullet wounds, the sort of wounds after which you would think he'd be left for dead. Indeed, perhaps he had been, for no normal person could survive such injuries. Whether he holds the Bible in his hands or a Colt, he is always surrounded by a stony, cool vibe, through which blows the icy breeze of death. The Pale Rider, on his pale horse, is one who has returned from the other side. The gloomy aura of death lingers around him and his beautiful horse, whose head shape betrays its thoroughbred provenance. Like many Westerns, Pale Rider is a cinematic ghost story. The character, who calls himself Marshall, the cynical leader of a band of hitmen, ends up being gunned down by the Pale Rider. His gunshot wounds reveal a similar pattern to that of the preacher's. The mill of repetition turns, as in all ghost stories. The burned-out hero makes a comeback as Revenant. When Revenants make their return on horseback, and indeed many do seem to, their mythological and iconological origins lie either in the misty climes of the north or in the balmy coves of the Aegean. Their screenplays were originally composed by John of Patmos and the anonymous army of creators of myths, legends, and figures of the pre- and sub-Christian Europa, St. John's Apocalypse, and North mythology, with their popular apocrypha and the broad field of superstition, all make up the fictional horse markets where the spirits of the dead come to procure their mounts. The Apocalypse of St. John the Apostle, Revelation 6, verses 1 to 8, brought us the four horsemen of the Apocalypse. The first, on a white horse, carries a bow, wears a crown, and is called Conquest. Traditionally interpreted as a ruler, he was identified with the victorious returning Christ. The second, on a red horse, carries a great sword and represents war and violence. The third, on a black steed, brandishes a pair of scales in the air as he announces famine. And the fourth, riding a pale horse, brings death by plague, war, and wild beasts. He is the pallid rider on an ashen horse, whose colorlessness recalls the pallor of one who is dying. This fourth horseman dominates the cultural imagination of North America, so influenced by Protestant ideology that finds its way into even the film scripts of Hollywood. Nordic and continental Germanic mythology is also characterized by an enormous cavalry, stretching back to Odin and his eight-legged steeple, Sleipnir. Since Jacob Grimm's anthology of Teutonic mythology, first published in 1835, the folklorists, mythologists, and philologists of the 19th and 20th centuries have never tired of collating all the local variants and subvariants of horseman legends, of sacred steeds, and devilish nags, a boundless hippo mythology which has never been granted its own grammar or theory of evolution. For literary narrators and authors of theoretical texts alike, this wealth of ethnographic positivism has provided an overflowing font of material, helping to tip realistic stories into the realm of fantasy and drawing theoretical constructions into the quicksand of ethnological sources. Any lover of theories could find what he was looking for in the gigantic and chaotic treasure trove of the great anthologies. When, in 1886, Theodore Storm began his last great novella, Der Schimmelreiter, The Dykemaster, he made liberal, if not excessive, use of the trappings of sagas and folklore to furnish the dramatic story of Dykemaster Hauke Haien. The tale is conceived as a ghost story, and there can be no doubt with whom the Faustian protagonist, the technically and mathematically talented, zealously modernizing Dykemaster, is in league, at least in the eyes of his suspicious fellow villagers and dyke workers. We lose count of the thinly veiled hints at the diabolical and the undead nocturnal apparitions, skeletons roaming in the moonlight, mermaids, monkfish, known in German as Seetüffel, sea devils, a seagull trampled under a horse's hooves, an animal sacrifice, and the last words of a dying man, the North German fantastical realm seems inexhaustible. We only encounter deeper and more subtle contours to the Dykemaster when the narrator holds up the mirror to reflect his grey horse. The mare that Hauke Haien buys from a suspicious-looking fellow, a Slovak whose brown hand looked almost like a claw, turns out, after a few weeks of tender nurturing, to be a noble thoroughbred. The rough hairs disappear, a shiny bluish-grey speckled coat comes to light. Above all, it has what an Arab horse should have, a thin, fleshless face, from which blazed two fiery brown eyes. In other words, the Dykemaster has been sold an Oriental pedigree, probably the only Arabian mare to have reached the stables of North German realism. For the Dykemaster's superstitious neighbors, the fleshless or sunken face of the Arabian only confirms their suspicion that the horse is as closely affiliated to the devil as his master and rider. Where he recognizes the signs of equine beauty, they see only a portentous skull. Moreover, with time, the master comes more and more to resemble his sinister mount, with his eyes staring from his gaunt face. The horse will not tolerate another rider besides his master, and responds to the pressure of his thighs like a lover. No sooner had he mounted, we read in Storm's narrative, which calibrates the chaste eroticism of married love by the pressure of the touch of a hand and the strength of color of a blush, than the animal uttered a neigh like a shout of delight. It would be the only shout of delight that, for generations, this set text brought to the classrooms of the nation. But if the Dykemaster is the pale rider of Norse mythology, then what does his horse represent? His curious existence develops in three phases. In the first stage, he stands on the beach of the coastal island, a skeleton that rises and roams at night. In the second phase, he is the Dykemaster's diabolically elegant riding horse. And in the third, after their common ruin, he reappears as the spirited skeleton. There's no doubt that his pale dapple grey represents the undead, a creature of terror tasked by the author to convey what remains unnamed in this novella, the death wish of a man who can no longer be helped on this earth. As the vital pendulum of the undead animal swings between the underworld and the world of the living, between stony chill and lustful heat, this beast bears the burden of horror. In Henry Fuseli's most famous painting, The Nightmare, of 1781 to 1782, the horse also appears as the embodiment of horror in both guise and function. The picture shows a curvaceous sleeping beauty, lightly clothed and half tumbling from the bed, with a demonically grinning incubus crouching on her chest, presumably the Alb, demon, from the German word Albtraum or Alptraum, nightmare, while behind him an eerily glowing horse head peers through the curtains into the murky midnight room. In another painting produced a few years later, around 1793, Fuseli delves into the dream world, making clearer the relationship between the two tormentors, the animal-like goblin and the horse. Entitled The Nightmare Leaves Two Sleeping Girls, the painting captures the Alb, the demon, riding away through the open window, leaving behind the two girls he has just afflicted. It is unclear, though, who or what is intended by the word nightmare, the monkey-like sprite, his mount, or both together. The phonetic correspondence in English between nightmare and mare, as in a horse, has meant that in the English-speaking world, including North America, the idea of a nightmare is intimately associated with the idea of the horse. Ernest Jones, student and biographer of Freud, included Fuseli's nightmare as the frontispiece to his 1949 study On the Nightmare, and dedicated an entire chapter to the interpretation of the sinister horse's head. He begins by noting that to ascribe the same etymology to both kinds of mare is a misconception arising from the confusing similarity of the two words, and that, in fact, the second part of nightmare derives from the Anglo-Saxon word mara, which was more like an incubus or succubus, that is, an erotic intruder at night. But, as Jones continued, it is possible that within this linguistic confusion lies another, deeper, dormant truth in the realm accessible by psychoanalysts. Philology might sleep calmly on its certainties, but suspicious psychoanalysis lies wide awake. And what if there was something in the mistaken correlation of the sexual demon and the horse? If the two acquaintances really were, in fact, related, as the English terms suggest. Jones is confident that when human beings and animals are put on an equal footing in a dream, there was always one underlying meaning. In a word, therefore, the presence of an animal in such contexts always denotes the action of an incest complex. This, in short, means for Jones that if a dream takes a person's breath away, and if it involves horses, that person must harbor incestuous desires. To start with, Jones stays in a similar territory to Max Jahns, mentioned above, who sums up his impressive collection of Nordic Germanic equine terms and idioms with the remark, "Quite peculiar, and without example, is the intimate juxtaposition of horse and woman in poetry, proverbial wisdom, and sayings. This juxtaposition is primeval." He describes a witch riding on a broom and the pole of a hobby horse in terms of animal worship within a phallic religion, which in turn would reveal much to deep psychoanalytic investigation. We have insensibly glided from the theme Mara equals mare to that of the horse as a phallic animal, but this illustrates the remarkable interchangeability of the sexes in this whole group of myths. The explanation of this state of affairs is that the forbidden wishes that furnish the driving force behind all these beliefs and myths are the repressed sexual desires of incest, and one of the most characteristic defenses against the becoming conscious of such desires is to repudiate them and conceal them through the mechanism of identification with the opposite sex. With the determination of someone foraging for mushrooms in a forest, Jones rummages through the wealth of literature and reaps the following gems: Odin and his nocturnal army, Death as a horseman, the horse and the sun, Zeus as miller, the significance of the horse skull, horses, water and urine, storm gods, the significance of the horse's hoof, the horseshoe, horse theft, horse manure, sex and neighing, the horse as oracle, the mare's shiny coat, the Teutonic magic steed, and so on. Behind all these legends and metamorphoses, he argues, lurks the repressed desire for incest. Seen through Jones's interpretation, these great collections of folklore, which just a few years earlier had also served the purposes of Aryan research, with different intentions but in a similar way, are turned into an evidence room bearing witness to the process of sexual repression. The entire stable of Nordic, Germanic, and even Mediterranean mythology is seen as a wardrobe of masks and costumes, disguising a latent desire for incest. If you want an example of how a tenuous theory can be dressed up with a persuasive explanation, look no further than Ernest Jones's interpretation of the nightmare. Erupting violence. The interpretation of Fuseli's nightmare, formulated a quarter of a century after Jones by the Swiss physician and literary scholar Jean Starobinsky, is only superficially psychological. Starobinsky follows the lines and figures of the famous painting before placing Fuseli, with a glance at his artistic oeuvre and biography, within the ideological and emblematic history of the revolutionary age. He describes the atmosphere of an oppressive, claustrophobic fear that imbues Fuseli's painting, but views it not as an expression of an inner psychic mechanism, rather as the painter's historical and moral philosophical statement. For Fuseli, there was no escape from this world of brutal violence. He cares nothing for the great day of history. Sin and death rule the world, and it is these that Fuseli's questions always address. Although Fuseli does not disguise the sexual possession of his subjects, the viewer of his works is not entering an intimate erotic theater. Fuseli dreams up the state of the world after the revolution, but unlike David, whose work takes on a diametrically opposite stance, he formulates his response not in classical drapery or in the future tense. Fuseli spells out the timeless ontology of evil in the philosophy of the boudoir. Starting from a close examination of the painting, Starobinsky refuses to be led back to the theme of incestuous desire. If this had been the correct interpretation, Fuseli would have deliberately chosen to depict a nightmare. However, it does not seem as though the artist intended to portray a gallery of cases in the vein of Jean-Marie Charcot's iconography of hysteria. As Starobinsky sees it, The painter is not penetrating into the pathology of fear, but is making a curiosity of anguish. He sees suffering. He evokes suffering. He observes the disintegration of the shrewd artifices manufactured by the beautiful temptress before the mirror for the purpose of conquest. He sees her in despair, an urgent state close to death. Unlike the Fuseli researcher Nicholas Powell, who had published a tome on the iconographic interpretation of Fuseli's nightmare the year before, Starobinsky did not inquire into the possible precedents for elements of the composition. In the case of the horse, perhaps Hans Baldung Green, Veronese's Venus and Mars with Cupid and a Horse, Play 24, or the statues of Castor and Pollux with their horses at the Dioscuri Fountain in Rome's Piazza de Quirinale. But rather he tracked down the literary sources behind the imagery. It is a visionary mise-en-scene, and it does what it wants with its dramatic and epic precedence. Fuseli performs the work he is reading with a pencil in his hand, and develops his graphic representation of the literary piece, intensively filling in his sketch, exploring its most hidden aspects. But despite this literary interpretation, Starobinsky did not overlook the idiosyncrasies of the representation. These were evident not only in the shapely lines of the sleeping woman, but also in the attention the painter pays to the third participant, the horse. Starobinsky notes the sudden violence of his intrusion. The appearance of the head and long neck in the gap between the curtains represents a violation. The body of the horse remains outside in the night. He also comments on the luminescence of the horse, as though it were a source of light, and specifically its eyes that shine like light bulbs. In the face of the horse, we encounter the paroxystic expression of an overpresence corresponding with the overabsence of the sleeping subject. He pointed to the forced opening of the space by the horse's intrusion. The room of the nightmare is forced open by the penetration of the horse bursting in from a distance, while the other two protagonists of the painting and the interior surrounding them are all calculated to convey an atmosphere of oppressive, weighty fear. The horse, on the other hand, embodies the sudden onset of sheer terror. Fuseli's drawings and paintings, writes Starobinsky, were always dominated by passionate violence. The night, murder, erotic seduction, and the singularity of evil are fixed values for him. The appearance of the horse, or rather of its head, in the scene of the nightmare, delivers a powerful formula to express the presence of violence in that it establishes a connection with the dynamics of penetration. The horse head represents the moment of erupting violence and conveys to the viewer, as the only appropriate form of response, the sensation of horror. On the 23rd of December 2002, the historian Reinhard Koselleck put into words for the first time an image which he had harbored in his memory for 60 years. It was the image of a severely injured horse that he had witnessed in the summer of 1942. I saw corpses whose skulls were half blown away in Barasor after the reconquest, but the corpses were dead. Then I saw this horse whose skull was half blown away and the horse was still alive, galloping along at full pelt through the marching column, deathly despair itself, and no one could deliver the horse from its fate, because there was no racehorse there that could catch up with it, and because a shot from a standing position would have posed a fatal risk to the marching soldiers. And so the horse raced on, with its half a skull, an inversion of the apocalypse. The horse did not carry an omen of death. It was the incarnation of human self-destruction that dragged everything along with it. The wounded horse seemed to have emerged from the apocalypse itself. But Koselleck knew it was not of literary provenance. There had been no script for this scene, no artistic precedent. The sinister event, too absurd to have been invented, had actually happened. He had seen it with his own eyes. How many times since then had the memory flashed back? When had he last seen the horse? Why did he only now pick up a pen to capture the memory? Was it only now that he recognized its full emblematic significance? It was like an invasion of the surreal into the reality of war, and was almost more horrific than the apocalypse, precisely because there was no longer a rider, because all that remained was the horse, its gaping wound, and its fatal despair. The apocalypse had descended upon the world, not from the outside, but as an occurrence of human self-destruction that dragged everything along with it. 60 years later, just before Christmas, Kosalek sat at his desk and wrote down what his memory gave him, suppressing the rising pathos. It cannot have been easy for him to capture in words the horror of the image that had accompanied him for so long. But he recognized what it boiled down to, the absence of a rider. It was that absence that made the scene absolutely unbearable. Even Fuseli's scenes had had literary or iconographic precursors. For the inversion of the apocalypse, there had been no script. The Whip. The man shall have his mare again, and all shall be well. William Shakespeare, A Midsummer Night's Dream. What once only the rural population knew from first-hand experience is now for everyone just a mouse click away. The next moment, you find yourself in a large hot zoo full of copulating animals, while their keepers clearly don't object. And we've all seen it on TV. You and me, baby, ain't nothing but mammals, so let's do it like they do on the Discovery Channel. Among all the animals in the zoo, it is the horses that appear to enjoy the most popularity. This may be down to their size and beauty, but may also be linked to other reasons, such as the idea that horses are particularly noble animals, and therefore chaster than others, or as untouchable as Brahmins. But then, there's the opposite view, one expressed by Aristotle, that horses have the strongest sex drive of all creatures after humans. Anyway, if you look up mating horses in your search machine zoo, you'll be offered an extensive list of options, including examples of the hardcore variety and contemporary variants on Greek mythology, where, as with the ancients, the species barrier between human and animal is casually skipped over. So, too, in the 2013 Icelandic film of Horses and Men, where one of the high points is a scene of lovemaking between two horses, while throughout the entire procedure, a man sits, somewhat perplexed and flustered, on the female horse, and remains sitting there quietly, because the stallion, far from embarrassed by his presence, takes not the slightest notice. Somewhat more dramatic is the scene in the play Medea, 1926, that Hans Henny Jahn has the older of Jason's two boys experience and recount. Finding himself sandwiched between two copulating horses, he is almost crushed to death. Narrowly escaping danger, he falls in love with the rider of the stallion in question, an Amazon girl, full of laughter, and suddenly feeling like a man, he begins to long for the young woman. But instead of seeing her again, he falls victim to his mother's hunger for revenge. In retrospect, the horse scene seems like a garishly ominous portent for the violence of sexuality, a force that destroys the life of the family and even rips to shreds the bonds of filial love. Since ancient times, sex has been considered a dangerous force, hazardous for the house and household, as well as for the cohesion of the community, especially when it expresses itself in forms that move beyond the broad realm of interpersonal relationships. Hans Baldur Grén's famous engraving of The Bewitched Groom stands out from the iconography of the Renaissance, looming like a dramatic warning sign, admonishing against the lure of bestiality, a sexual urge to which a human male can succumb. With extreme and humbling foreshortening, the composition shows a stable boy lying supine on the ground, while behind him, in the central axis of the picture, we see the vulva of a mare whose buttocks shimmer in the light. For Pierre F. Caneo, professor of art history at the University of Arizona, and herself a keen rider, the tangible misogynistic allusions in the picture are unmissable, especially for an educated audience that is intimately familiar with the equine literature of the time. In some of the hippological literature, discussion of ideal equine conformation often includes comparison between a well-shaped horse and a beautiful woman. According to this comparison, both horse and woman should possess a shapely posterior, a desire to be ridden, and the ability to make pleasant movements underneath their riders. Caneo interprets the engraving, completed a year before the artist's death, as a warning to the humanistically educated wealthy and noble horse-owning lair of the society of his time, against the consequences of an excessive love for the beautiful animal. Bestiality is something, albeit rare, to which the eroticism between men and horses can lead. Literature has certainly known of it since the reference by the Roman writer Aelian to a case recounted by Eudemus concerning the stable boy who fell in love with a mare. The other apex of the erotic pendulum is the latent sexuality of endless waves of young girls, who throughout the generations have transformed the riding school into a pleasure ground of pubescent and teenage nymphs. Somewhere in between, but where, there is the confusing terrain of the pleasures of torment and obedience, and the associated toys, poses, and whips. These pleasures cannot dispense with images of riding and pulling without the imagery of equine love. Leaving aside the reality of bestiality, in which the times and places where people such as shepherds or grooms coexisted in close quarters with the animals in their care may indeed have played a certain role, we are still left with the imagery, metaphors, and cultural coding, a whole phenomenology of sexuality between men and horses in the hypothetical. But only very few of those things that we commonly refer to as images exist without a connection to the supposedly other, imageless reality. And vice versa, this is intimately asserted with images, signs, and symbols, and would probably not be perceived without their existence. And thus the images and symbols are associated with reality through countless threads and particles, and can only unfurl as a result of their impact. Sexuality, as banal as it seems, is the reality most mediated and punctuated by images. Some even assert that it consists of nothing other than images and discourse. If, for example, we wanted to understand the phenomenon of the horse girls, it is not enough to speak of projections and cultural codes, unless we consider where they are directed, namely at these large, characterful animals of outstanding beauty, with their own behavior and their special smell. Horses are not teddy bears or smartphones, but very special, living creatures, which we do not only project ourselves onto, but which we can also fall in love with. They are a kind of living metaphor. But the horse girls are a special case, a world unto themselves. The other phenomenon, which also falls within this chapter, is the riding and driving school of desire, to which we were introduced by the novelists of the 19th century. Pretty much all the well-known 19th century novels of love and adultery turn out, on closer inspection, to be equine novels. They could not exist without the large, warm body of this odd-toed ungulate. The literature shows how people toy with animal imagery, picture themselves as animals, and are able, when dressing up or hiding behind an equine mask, to say what otherwise can only be left ambiguously unspoken. Triad in Bronze. Close to one another, at Berlin's Alte Nationalgalerie, stand three large bronze sculptures in which horses play a supporting role. Chronologically, they are also close to one another. The oldest originated in the years after the unification of Germany, the most recent in 1900. Here, the similarities are exhausted, and the list begins of their differences. A comparison of the three sculptures seems to circumscribe the realm of erotic possibilities that opens up between men, women, and horses, be they literary, graphic, sculptural, or whatever. Since we cannot have all three sculptures in our field of vision at one time, a synopsis is not possible in the strictest sense, so let us examine them in turn. One tends to begin with the largest of the three sculptures, the most mighty, although not necessarily the most beautiful, the equestrian statue of Friedrich Wilhelm IV, which towers above the viewer on its high plinth in front of the entrance to the gallery. Based on a design by Gustav Blaser, the work was executed by the Berlin sculptor Alexander Calandrelli between 1875 and 1886, the date of its installation at the gallery. It shows the King of Prussia and patron of the arts riding his steed in a southerly direction, not, as all the clues in the monument might lead us to expect, in a westerly direction towards France. The king has a thoroughly martial presence. The horse, a stallion of strong physique and ostentatious masculinity, strides with vigor and yet with restraint. It carries its rider, a man of powerful build, energetically towards an invisible opposition. Everything about this preeminent dual entity, from the horse's flared nostrils to its strikingly bushy tail, represents a dynamic expression of strength. The contrast with The Amazon on a Horse by Louis Toyon, which stands to the right of the regal horseman on the long side of the new museum in Berlin, could not be greater. The youthful warrior, riding bareback, with a small, only slightly menacing axe in her hand, is draped in a light chiton, which accentuates her dainty figure rather than veiling it, leaving her upper thigh uncovered. Where she touches the horse, the Amazon is completely naked. Unlike the statue of the Prussian king, which emphasizes the sense of distance, Toyon's Amazon invites empathy. Not in the sense that she turns the viewer into a rider who feels the horse's every movement. In fact, the animal stands still and holds its head slightly turned to the left. But in the way she conveys to the viewer the warmth of the horse's body, the beat of its heart, and the pulsing of its blood. The serene grace, the lightness of the sculpture, makes it quite possible for the viewer to assimilate the pair entirely, and to empathize with the eroticism that is discernible in the contact between the two bodies. For a brief moment, the viewer becomes an Amazon, whose bronze eyes scan the broad square. The third sculpture, Centaur and Nymph, installed in front of the colonnade on the other side of the National Gallery, is the work of the neo-Baroque sculptor Reinhold Begas, a student of the Rauschule. It shows an elderly bearded centaur, not dissimilar to the artist himself, helping a young naked nymph up to sit side-saddle on his back. In his younger years, Begas had lived and studied for a time in Rome, where he met the artists Anselm Feuerbach and Arnold Böcklin, whose sometimes crudely sensual art seems to have been an inspiration behind this portrait of a gallant centaur. Although the sculpture of the two mythical beings, both handsomely built and erotically charged, is clearly intended to charm the viewer, the latter nevertheless remains at a safe remove. The narrative of the sculpture reduces its seductive power. It does nevertheless open up the associations of a centurion love life, where, often enough, seduction pairs with abduction, and the threat of violence can tilt the game of love between the sexes into something darker. The horse, which one might think would play the strongest role in this third sculpture, with it having a more active part to play as a centaur, is in fact cheated of some of its phenomenal impact because of sharing a hybrid body with a bearded human. Unlike the statue of the Prussian king, where the horse provides the entire dynamic spectacle of the show of power, and unlike the mare's quiet serenity in the Amazonian sculpture, the centaur is not a real horse. He cannot parade the horse's distinctive strengths, but rather, as a four-legged old man of legend, he draws the erotic scene back into the realm of the text. Until the 20th century, the game of seduction and ravishment, which constantly threatened to tip over into violence, was often depicted by means of the centaur. It was a symbol that German painter and illustrator Max Levogt also drew on. Although lustful ruffians by nature, centaurs can age into gentler, wiser veterans, above such lascivious horseplay. We see this in the example of the ancient educator of princes, the senior centaur, Chiron. Moreover, such bawdy behavior clearly occurs in art without any centaurs being involved. Quite ordinary horses also appear as a dynamizing element foreshadowing the sexual act, as we see in The Rape of the Daughters of Leucippus by Rubens, Plate 22. Another example is The Abduction of a Young Girl, by the late Baroque godfather of Impressionism, Franz Anton Malbersch. While the young woman, in the arms of her abductor, looks back in horror at the body of her decapitated companion, the horse appears in the role of seducer, and throws the beautiful, unfortunate maiden a look of compassion mixed with desire. Malbersch, the sensitive colorist, lets everything else be said in the colors, the milky white skin of the young woman, and the same tone in the shimmering coat of the white stallion, hint that these bodies will soon become one flesh. Goya's etching, El Caballo Raptor, the horse abductor, reveals the disturbing power that can emanate from an image, when we see the inversion as described by Kosalek. It is one of the Los Disparates, or Proverbios, series of prints produced by the Spanish artist between 1815 and 1823. One could translate raptor differently and more harshly, and label the horse a robber or a rapist. There is violence in the air of this scene, no doubt, and any critic who, like Robert Hughes, interprets the woman's expression as nothing but an orgasm is projecting rather than truly looking at the picture. What prompts the horse, rearing up in the levard position, to bite at the woman as she stares at him frozen? Does he want to steal her away, kidnap her, seduce her, harm her? Or does he intend to carry her to safety from God knows what other danger? Is the raptor perhaps a diligent rescuer who has snatched the woman from greater harm? Perhaps from the threat of being devoured by the beasts in the background of the image? What kind of beasts are these that seem to live in water like oversized beavers or rats? When we look more closely, we notice that the horse is also standing with its hind legs in the floodwater, so that its wet tail is sticking to its legs. Suppose now that the animals in the picture represent the might of land and sea. The plump rats stand in for the leviathan, and the horse for the behemoth, the long-toothed monster, the ruler of the land. What would the message of the engraving be then? And what would the woman represent? The iconographic tradition to which Goya's picture tips its hat is the same one that shows through in Reinhold Begaard's work, the compositional formula of the centaur carrying away a nymph on his back. But at the crucial point, referred to in Kosalek's concept of inversion, Goya departs from the well-trodden path of tradition. He grants the horse, and the horse alone, certain attributes which were previously associated with the centaur, or with violent men mounted on horses. El Caballo, by contrast, is very much a horse, not a centaur. Rather than playing in the well-lit theme park of Greek mythology, Goya digs down to subvert the political menagerie. What does the woman see behind her closed eyes? The violence facing her, or the violence that looks behind her? Bright Young Amazons. With her low-budget production of Girls and Horses, 2014, Monica Troitt was returning to her roots as a filmmaker, as she writes in the press release for her equestrian coming-of-age movie. Horses were my best friends during my difficult adolescent years. I was fascinated by the community of girls and horses, a community without boys and men. The bond between the animals and the girls and women, the physicality and energy of riding, grooming and taming these shy and strong prey animals, had its own eroticism that enthralled us girls and kept us grounded. From this innocent, energetic perspective, I wanted to tell a simple story from my own experience. How a troubled teenager can slowly, through contact with the horses, build a relationship with herself and build trust in others. Pubescent Girls and Horses. Like all great love stories, this one remains an enigma. Psychologists have, of course, sought to explain it. As a rule, their conceptions of sexual development are oriented towards the model of heterosexuality. In these theories, the horse is presented as the last substitute before choosing a male partner, a kind of transfer object. Somewhere between a doll and a real-life partner, the horse is the ultimate soft toy. It's the largest, most beautiful and final plaything before the transition from home and family to a new relationship with a sexual partner. In contrast, Monica Troitt depicts a world outside this teleology. Horses and girls establish a world unto itself, based on the bond between the animals and the girls and women. In this world, the horse is more than a mere cargo ship, slowly but surely carrying the libido of the teenage girl to the shores of heterosexual attachment. Its physis, its vitality, its strong animated body, and its dynamis, expressed in the energy of the ride, give rise, in connection with the physical care for the horse, to an erotic charge that for a certain period gives contentment in the relationship and the bond. How long this lasts, how durable the communities of girls and horses are, is something the author doesn't dwell on. But the energetic perspective makes it possible to see these mini female republics as temporary symbioses in their own right, girls and horses are islands in the flowing river of time. For a few years, the riding school is a counter-existence remote from the world of school and family life, an adventure